Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, we'll look back on interviews we recorded with some of the best progressive candidates from around the country who are challenging incumbents in an effort to bring progressive policies to the forefront. Let's listen to this. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. We're continuing our interview series in 2020 with progressive candidates from across the country. This week, we feature Charles Booker. He's running for the U.S. Senate in Kentucky against Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. So, Charles, I mean, let's obviously, I think your potential opponent in the general election is one of the is a very well known to many of our listeners. We can talk about Mitch McConnell in a bit, but why don't you tell us a little bit about your history, your experience, both in terms of having grown up in Louisville and also in terms of what you've done in the state assembly.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. It's truly an honor. I listen to you. And thank you for asking, because my story, my background growing up in Kentucky is really what inspired me to stand up to this incredible challenge now. And, you know, I'm from the west end of Louisville in Kentucky, and Louisville's one of the most segregated cities in the country. And I live now in what has been the poorest zip code in the state. And, you know, it really shaped my perspective on the world and on challenges that Kentuckians face, and really inspired me to want to do something about it, because I grew up in poverty. Both my parents dropped out of high school to take care of the family, and I was on food stamps and free lunch all through school. And, you know, I knew then that it wasn't because we were deficient. It wasn't because we didn't work hard. My mom worked multiple jobs, and even when she did, I'd still come home, the lights be cut off, water be cut off, and she'd go without eating so I could eat at times. And that really showed me that there are a lot of Kentuckians that understand that story, that have worked hard and still are struggling to get by. And, you know, it led me into this focus towards public service. And what I've been able to do in my career is something that's really humbling. I've been able to work in every level of government, but it's really been focused on how do we elevate the voices of folks that are unheard and left out of the conversations for the decision that shaped their lives. And I walk into every room really telling who I am. You know, that's why I do this work. And I often share about how I'm a type 1 diabetic. And, you know, the experiences I've faced in not being able to afford my insulin, having to ration it, and nearly dying from diabetic ketoacidosis really influenced why I push on issues that will make sure that all Kentuckians have access to quality health care. And in the state legislature, being able to do just that, even in a very dysfunctional legislature that was governed by one of the most ridiculous governors in our history, Matt Bevin, which thank goodness he's gone, was able to get legislation passed with bipartisan support. And a lot of it was because of the fact that, you know, I shared that story. We were able to pass Kevin's Law here in Kentucky that allows for emergency prescription refills. And again, it's even at the height of dysfunction, we can get things done if we see each other and hear each other and take a stand together. And that's really what this movement is about in challenging Mitch McConnell, because I'll tell you for a fact, this is not a partisan statement. Kentuckians do not like Mitch McConnell. And it is very evident how much he controls at the state level and how much progress he blocks. And while our families are suffering and dying, he's calling himself the Grim Reaper. And, you know, this is really a moment where we're saying we've had enough of it. And, you know, just seeing the teachers organize this year like never before, right, and come down to the Capitol to say that we're not going to be left behind, those miners in Harlan County that, you know, as these coal companies are shutting down, which we knew was going to be happening, even though Trump was lying and saying that he was going to bring these jobs back. We know he was selling snake oil. But there were folks that were standing on the tracks to stop these big companies from running Kentuckians over. That's the energy that we're tapping into now to say that not only are we looking to beat Mitch McConnell, but we're looking to win our future.
I mean, that is one of the things I have to say, that the profile of Kentucky is fascinating. I mean, you mentioned the teacher strikes, which, you know, took place across the country, inspired by what happened in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And those miners who I think it was what, like 2 or 3 months they were out there,
yeah,
blocking those trains, carrying that coal. And of course, you just had the defeat of Bevin, who I think, you know, a lot of people have a different, you know, there are differing perspectives on exactly what led to his ouster. He seemed to be a guy who would be pretty easy to vote for, vote against, I should say, even for Kentuckians. So, with all that said, like, you know, what's happening in Kentucky, do you think, that is making this change? I mean, one of the things that also strikes me is we saw people come out to save Medicaid expansion. How much do Kentuckians perceive it as Medicaid as opposed to Kentucky Connect? I mean, like, what is happening there that, and to what extent, and what, I guess, instigated that change, if there is one?
Yeah, well, you know what I'm seeing in my community and all over the Commonwealth is that Kentuckians are really ready for change, not just in talking about it. And I think what has helped a lot of folks get to this point of urgency is really just how terrible Matt Bevin was, and in a lot of respects, how folks have realized that Donald Trump was lying to them. You know, there were some across Kentucky that took a chance on these guys who were rightfully calling out the fact that the system is broken.
Right.
But on the other side of that, what they were getting is exploited, lied to, demeaned, disrespected. And I think what you saw with Matt Bevin in particular is that Kentuckians were saying, wait a minute, we're not going to be disrespected anymore. And Mitch McConnell, like I said, is one of the most unpopular senators in the country for a reason. He was elected 2 weeks after I was born. And so for my entire life, this guy has been scrutinized. And people do not like him, but the question is that, well, he's been in so long, well, what do we do that's different? And I think what you're seeing, and like you mentioned, the teacher strikes and folks organizing across the Commonwealth, is we're starting to realize that what we need to do differently is take a stand together. And that's what gives me hope, you know, because Kentuckians deserve a senator that's going to fight for them and not against them and not treat us like a political poker chip that is exposable. We know Mitch McConnell doesn't care about us. He knows that. We know he knows, and he doesn't care about that either. And now it's a matter of saying, okay, we pay for this office. It belongs to the people. We're going to take it back, and we're going to build a future where poverty is not generational anymore. And I'm telling you, there is a real excitement on the ground, and it is not partisan. This is folks from all ends of the political spectrum that are saying, you know, we need to fight back, and we deserve a better future. And I think Matt Bevin being gone is an example of that, but we got to build on that.
Right.
Because, you know, again, my grandparents didn't graduate high school. My parents didn't. And poverty was passed down from generation to the next. And I'm trying to prevent having to pass it down to my daughters. You know? So this is very personal for us. And it's not something that we could ever decide to play politics on or say, let's wait. Let's allow the folks with big money to finally decide to care about us. We can't play those games anymore.
Well, Charles, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk specifically what set of issues you would champion as a senator. I want to talk not only about you replacing Mitch McConnell, but you mm-hmm. are going to be facing, obviously, a fight in the primary, too. And I want to hear why you believe that what you are offering to Kentucky will be more compelling, both as a means in which to defeat Mitch McConnell, but also for Democrats in Kentucky looking for their challenger to Mitch McConnell. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I'll be right back with Democrat Charles Booker, who is running for the Democratic nomination to face Mitch McConnell for Senate in Kentucky. We'll be right back after this. So, Charles, in the last segment, you gave us a little bit of your background. You live in the poorest zip code in Kentucky, and you spoke about growing up in poverty, at one point having to ration your insulin, and your folks who left high school to take care of their family. And so you have a real sense of the struggles of the least advantaged in Kentucky, and you did mention it's one of the most segregated states. I mean, how much does that play into? I mean, how much are you as a would-be challenger to Mitch McConnell, but also in the context of your Democratic primary? How much are you counting on activating folks in Kentucky who in the past have maybe not voted because they just don't see government as a mechanism to bring them any type of like material change.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, Kentucky has been one of the most disenfranchised states in the country as well. And, you know, I hear it from my own family. One, we've had a lot of laws that are very restrictive. But for folks that are even, you know, allowed to vote, the question is often, well, what's the point? And I understand that because for a long time we've been ignored. We've been disrespected. And the folks that have been in office, and Mitch McConnell is the orchestrator of this, have created this corrupt game that is really all about them building power and wealth while we're stuck trying to figure out how we keep the lights on or put food on the table. And the opportunity, which is why I'm saying we have to build a movement, is to inspire people to believe their voice matters. That, you know, no matter where you come from in the Commonwealth, how much money you have in your pocket, who you love, what you believe, whether you're walking or in a wheelchair, you matter. And your voice matters. And if we stand, we can do big things. And of course we can beat Mitch McConnell. I think that's the part that excites me, and that's the energy you're seeing on the ground, because, like I said, we all know how terrible Mitch McConnell is. So just simply pointing out that he doesn't care or that he is in it for himself is not really going to be what motivates folks to take a stand and do something different, because we're so used to that. And, you know, I think there has been a model, particularly in the Democratic Party, when challenging Mitch McConnell, in sort of running to some sort of soft center and not really taking strong positions, not really listening to Kentuckians or taking the fight directly to Mitch McConnell. And people are tired of that, but not only are we tired of it, we're dying because of it. You look at essentially every measurable index of a good quality of life, we're at the bottom. And I mentioned that I'm a type 1 diabetic. You just go down the list. We're suffering, and it's not because we don't work hard, and it's not because we deserve it, but it's because we have a senator that doesn't give a damn about us. And the fact that you have, you know, a young black man from the poorest zip code in Kentucky that is living the struggle that a lot of politicians talk about, and Mitch McConnell doesn't even acknowledge that exists, telling my story and saying that we can do something different is really inspiring a lot of folks to believe that, you know what, we can do this, and we can fight back. And what we're going to see, what I'm pushing for, is not only to, you know, beat Mitch McConnell, but to encourage folks to run for office at the state and local level so that we can have fighters for Kentuckians all across the board. And that's the movement right there. And I'm excited to be a part of it.
You know, it's fascinating because I think, you know, what we're seeing in Kentucky with your opponent in the Democratic primary is analogous to what we're seeing on a national level, right? The real question is, you know, can you just simply say Mitch McConnell or Donald Trump on a national level is bad? Or do you need to be able to say that and then say, here is a positive, not just in terms of optimism, but an active, proactive agenda. Let's talk a little bit about that. You have come out strongly for the Green New Deal. Now, the conventional wisdom is like, how could you do that in Kentucky? Because it's coal country, and the knee-jerk response to the idea that, you know, you're going to push a Green New Deal is that, you know, somehow that leaves coal miners behind. How do you go out and you sell that, the Green New Deal in Kentucky?
Well, you know what? I even take it a step further and say that we need a Kentucky New Deal, that we need to be leading on our future. And the reason that I push for this is not because some outside group is consulting me or that I'm trying to win political points. It's because I'm listening to Kentuckians. Now, you got to get past the political BS. And, you know, some folks, because how things are branded now, as soon as you hear the Green New Deal, a lot of misinformation is out there. And, you know, folks get in their political corners. But when you sit down and ask folks, do you want to turn on the faucet and see orange water coming out? Do you want to have to hold your nose when you're walking in your community because the chemical plants are putting emissions in the air that are making you sick? And if you talk to miners like I have, they have known for a while that these coal jobs were leaving. They're not surprised by this. The problem is that it's their livelihood. And as these coal companies file bankruptcy and leave them high and dry, we have our sisters and brothers that are saying, well, what am I going to do? And so the opportunity to protect our environment, but also push for justice and make sure that Kentuckians have a pathway to live gainful lives, economic opportunity in their communities, is something that we want. And, you know, we can't let folks like Mitch McConnell define the politics and convince us that poverty is what we deserve. We've had enough of that. And so we're going to be bold, and we're going to take the fight directly to Mitch and anyone else that thinks that we should be okay with being sick and seeing our jobs disappear and having those men and women go down in those mines and come up with black lung only to have Mitch McConnell turn his back on them. We're done with that.
And I know that you are also a supporter for Medicare for All. When you say Medicare for All, are you talking about something along the lines of what Pramila Jayapal and Bernie Sanders have sponsored in the House and Senate, respectively? And if so, do you think that what took place, the sensitivity that was risen in terms of just the Medicaid expansion in Kentucky, if that in some way helps make that pitch to Kentuckians?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think that because of how successful the expansion was in Kentucky, one, in part because we want to be healthy. We want to live gainful lives. We want to be able to see our children grow up and to be able to retire and to be able to see our generations thrive and flourish. We want that. Every American should, and I'm sure they do, and we do too. And so we don't have to sell the idea of everyone having health care. We know how important it is. And, you know, that's why I'm so transparent with my own lived experience, because when I say that no one should have to die because they don't have money in their pocket, I nearly died because I didn't have money in my pocket. I fell into diabetic ketoacidosis because I was rationing my insulin to make sure my girls could eat. And I'm going to tell you now, I'm going to choose my girls every day of the week. And that's the story that Kentuckians know about. And so the reality is, especially here in the Commonwealth, because so many families are suffering and struggling, we cannot be incremental in how we approach our priorities. And so when we're talking about expanding health care and push for Medicare for All, it is imperative that we treat it as a sense of urgency, because it is. And what we can't afford is our senator scoffing at that, insulting us and saying, well, just call me the Grim Reaper.
Right.
You know, I was talking to a young man in McCracken County down in West Kentucky just a couple of days ago that said that, well, Charles, because you've taken a stand, I'm going to as well. And he just found out his mother's cancer has returned. I mean, this is something that we deal with all the time. And so the opportunity to be bold in the eyes of some is really us doing what we should have been doing a long time ago.
Well, I got to say, Charles, that, you know, in prep of this interview, I went to BookerForKentucky.com, your website, and I watched your ad, and I got to say, we're out of time here, but that ad is one of the most moving ads, and I think one of the most powerful ads I've seen in this cycle. And I wish you all the luck, and I suspect that when people go and visit that website and listen to that ad and take a look at you, you're going to get support from across the country. And just with 20 seconds left, like, what are you looking for people? I imagine donations and volunteers.
Yeah, we're building a movement of regular folks taking a stand. Even if you don't have a lot of money in your pocket, your voice matters. If folks can go to BookerForKentucky.com and join up with us, chip in what they can, and spread the word. We're building a movement in Kentucky, and I'm asking you to keep your eyes on this, because we're going to bring some things and shake up Washington.
We will do. Charles Booker, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, sir.
Charles Booker is running for the Democratic nomination for the Senate in Kentucky. You can find out more about Charles's campaign over at BookerForKentucky.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. We're continuing our Progressive Candidate Spotlight, where we highlight progressive candidates who are challenging the establishment. This week, we feature Nabila Islam, who is running in Georgia's 7th Congressional District. So, Nabila, let's start with you telling us a little bit of something about Georgia's 7th Congressional District.
Sure. So the 7th Congressional District is northeast of Atlanta. So it's the suburbs. It's Metro Atlanta. It's a majority-minority district, and it's comprised of two counties. It's Forsyth and Gwinnett County. And Gwinnett is 85% of the district, and it's the most diverse county in the southeast and the fourth most diverse county in America. And it's a district that's never had any reflective representation before. And last year, the Republican only won it by 433 votes. So it was the closest federal election in the entire country. It's now an open seat, and And it's also a working class district. The median income here is about $72,000. And it's, as I mentioned, a very diverse community, and I'm running for Congress in it.
Okay, tell us a little bit about the incumbent, obviously a Republican. How long has this seat been in Republican hands?
So it was redistricted in 2010. So for the past 10 years, the specific district has, for about a decade now, Congressman Rob Woodall, and who announced he was retiring back last February. So he's one of the first Republicans to say he was retiring.
And so this is going to be an open seat. I mean, give me a sense of who you are, who else is in this race, and who you anticipate will be the Republican nominee.
So I am in a primary myself. There are about 9 Republicans vying for the nomination. The 2 Republicans that I think will probably make it through are State Senator Renee Unterman, who was the senator who pushed the anti-abortion bill last year in Georgia. She was basically the author and the mastermind behind it. And another woman named Lynn Homrick, who decided this year which political party that she was going to affiliate herself with and is now running as a Republican, but she's pretty much a self-funder.
I see. And you're in, obviously, a Democratic primary. Give us a sense of your background. I mean, what in your mind it qualifies you for this race?
So I am in a 6-state primary, and I'm actually the only candidate that grew up here. And so I have a shared lived experience with my community. I've gone to public schools here. I've worked low-wage jobs here. My parents have lived here as well. And I'm running on policies on a progressive platform that is going to effectuate for real change in our community. And the other candidates are in this race. They're running on Republican light platforms. And I don't think they really resonate with the district. They don't get folks excited. And so I really believe that a candidate that not only reflects its diversity, but its values will be the candidate that would make it out of the primary. And because in Georgia, we have a rule that you have to make above 50% to become the nominee. And so there will likely be a primary runoff in July. And then from there, the candidate will become the nominee. But as far as my background, I'm the daughter of working class immigrants from Bangladesh. Both my parents are survivors of a genocide, and they came to this country about 40 years ago seeking the American dream and better economic opportunities. I myself am one generation removed from growing up in a tin hut, mud floor home with no electricity, no running water like my own mother did. And they came to Gwinnett County and they worked hard. They found opportunities here, and they gave me an opportunity to succeed. And I grew up here, and I was the first person in my family to go to college. So I really understand the day-to-day struggles this community goes through. And I think it's very important that we have someone in Congress that understands the firsthand experiences of the people living in the district.
And I know that you've had some experience working in the district, various low-wage job. What else in your career do you think sets you up for this? I mean, we're living in an era where I think voters are far more open to just simply the candidate's ideas, right? I mean, AOC, if it was a question of her, you know, her prior qualifications, was working in a restaurant or a bar.
Mm-hmm.
But the ideas were compelling. Is that the way that you perceive that you're going to convince voters is based upon those issue sets that you subscribe to?
I believe that my policies, when I'm on the campaign trail talking about my policies, it really resonates with the community. I think that for so long, especially in Georgia, folks have been shy of running on bold, progressive platforms. I think for so long, we Democrats here have thought that the winning strategy was to appeal to Republicans. And because of that, we've watered ourselves down. And I don't think that's an effective strategy. I think that's why time and again, we candidates here continue to not be successful. And I think this is a district that is hungry for someone that will speak up for them and give their give this community a real voice at the table. You know, post-college, I got involved in community organizing. I actually founded our Gwinnett Young Democrats, which is an organization that has served as a pipeline in our community for folks to get involved civically. And also a couple of people from the group have actually run for office themselves. And so I've, you know, I've worked on campaigns up and down the ballot and trying to give Georgia, this country, candidates that will give them a real voice at the table.
All right. Well, I want to just before we, you know, break, I want to just touch on some of the issues that you are prioritizing and the ones that you're running on, you know, more broadly. We can talk about on the other break. But from your perspective, you know, relative to the member, you know, the voters in Georgia's 7th district, what are the top priorities for people there?
Healthcare is definitely a top priority. 135,000 people in this district do not have access to healthcare. That's about 25% of this district.
Wow.
And it's a very major issue. I myself don't have healthcare because I can't afford it running for Congress. It's also immigration is a huge policy point that people care about, immigration reform. And so 25% of this district is foreign-born. It's a very diverse community. Gwinnett itself is about, you know, it's 21% African-American, 20% Hispanic, and about 17% AEPI. And we have a program called 287G that 2% of counties around the country implement. And it basically, what it does is it deputizes our local sheriffs with powers that ICE has. And so basically that they can go around detaining people and issue them for deportation, and which is why Gwinnett County has the highest amount of deportations in the entire state.
Wow.
And also, as I mentioned before, it's a working class district. And so the minimum wage here is $7.25, paired with increasing living costs. It's becoming more and more difficult just to live off a minimum wage, to be able to afford rent or your mortgage. And so that's been a huge priority that people have been vocalizing on the campaign trail.
All right. Well, we'll take a break. When we come back, we will discuss those issues in depth and more. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with Nabila Islam running for Congress in Georgia's 7th district. It is an open seat with a retirement from a Republican. You need to get a 50% threshold in a Georgia primary, or you will end up in a runoff. We'll be right back to hear more of what Nabila calls the people's priorities. We'll be right back after this. So, Nabila, in the last segment, you basically walked us through a description of Georgia's 7th district. It is, I think, by your description, one of the most diverse, if not the most diverse, in Georgia. It has been represented by a Republican congressman who is stepping down. This is a Republican who, you know, I think their resignation, or I should say a retirement, is probably consistent with a lot. He won by, you said, only about 450 votes, a little bit less in 2018, has probably by all reasoning expects that he would have a tougher time this go around. You have jumped into this race. You outlined for me, you know, your background, and you mentioned that that healthcare was a primary top priority of people in Georgia's 7th, which is frankly fairly consistent across the country. I know you mentioned that you don't have health insurance yourself, can't afford it, running for Congress. My understanding is you put your student loans on forbearance. Tell us about what you would support when it comes to health care. It says Medicare for All on your website. Are we talking about the bills that are in Congress? What is Medicare for All from your perspective?
So Medicare for All is a single payer healthcare system that doesn't leave anyone behind, that, you know, recognizes that healthcare is a fundamental human right. And so that's what I'm supporting unabashedly, unapologetically. And I, you know, Georgia just did a poll on this. 60% of Democrats actually support Medicare for All. And so it's been really resonating on the ground with folks as I've been campaigning for the past year now. And so that's been a top priority that I've been consistent in speaking about.
When people, when you talk about Medicare for All people, when you hear from the other 40% that are against it, what are their complaints? I mean, what are their concerns, I should say, I guess, about Medicare for All?
So they want to see a single payer healthcare system that doesn't leave anyone behind. They are, you know, they're concerned with rising premiums. They're concerned with large deductibles. My mom herself actually recently enrolled on the exchange, and because of, I guess, administrative confusion, she thought her premium was going to be $200, and they did a direct deposit from her bank account, and they took out $600. And because she didn't fill out some piece of paper, and so now she's canceled her health insurance because she can't afford $600 a month. It's becoming increasingly, the current system is becoming increasingly unaffordable for folks. And the fact that, you know, people can't afford it is a huge problem. And so that's why they're supportive of a single payer healthcare system, because they recognize that this would cost a lot less and that this would cover everyone. And we wouldn't have to, you know, go through the headache of the billing system that we've created under our current healthcare system.
Yeah, I think my sense is that the value of not having to be an accountant when you're trying to just get your health insurance, I think, is undersold largely, like just from a convenience and stress level, et cetera. I mean, obviously the cost, but all right. We also mentioned immigration reform. You have a lot of immigrants in that district. What does immigration reform mean? Like specifically, what type of things would you support?
Prioritizing a real pathway to citizenship for the 11 million undocumented people that live in this country. Prioritizing ending predatory policies like 287G and ending them at the federal level. You know, immigrants work hard and they contribute so much to our society and our economy, and they should be given an option, a pathway to citizenship. We need to, you know, reinstate and strengthen DACA, DAPA, and TPS orders. And also what's going on at the border is just gut-wrenching, that we're putting kids in cages. And, you know, seeking asylum is a human right. And these people that are coming to our border are in real danger, and they're seeking asylum in the United States. And instead of, you know, creating a process of having folks go through our system, we are now criminalizing them and treating them like criminals. And so that's what a comprehensive immigration reform would look like to me.
You also mentioned economic equity on your site as one of the top priorities that you would pursue. What does that mean?
That means increasing the minimum wage to living wage. And I'm advocating increasing it to $15 an hour and it'd be adjusted to inflation thereafter. That would mean also that creating a fair tax system, that wealthy people and large corporations pay their fair share and the burden isn't put on the working class, middle class. That also means we have a lot of people in our community we're having more and more folks from our diverse communities that are opening up small businesses. And, you know, I've talked about how we are currently sending billions of dollars of our own tax dollars to subsidize corporations like Amazon and Boeing when they pay $0 in federal taxes. And so creating a system where our tax dollars come back to our local communities and creating subsidies for our small businesses so that they can flourish and also, you know, have the money to also pay their workers a living wage. And also strengthening our unions. I think wealth inequality, income inequality is at an all-time high. And we need to support our workers.
Those are the top three that you have on your site. You of course, you talk about common sense gun reform, talk about reproductive justice. These are two big issues in Georgia. Education, criminal justice reform, environmental crisis, LGBTQIA rights, to mention a few. So let me ask you this. We got about a minute and a half left here. What is your theory in terms of how you will win this election? You're running against other Democrats who are taking more of a centrist position. This is what we've seen out of Georgia, and often when we see out of states that are trying to turn, or districts that are trying to turn red from blue. This is, 430 votes. It's basically a purple district. But what's your theory? How will you go about doing this operationally?
So my strategy is to energize the base and expand the electorate and not water myself down in order to gain Republican votes, which we've too often seen in this state, and advocating for policies that will advocate for transformational change in our communities. I'm the only candidate that actually has policies on their website, and I'm not afraid to take a position. I think it's important to have conviction. We've been in the field since late October, knocking on doors and being across. We're all over the district right now in different communities. And there's a very large Bangladeshi community, Vietnamese community, Korean, Mexican community. And we are making sure that we are available, that we're speaking to everyone. And I think that this race will be won on the ground. So we have a strong field operation. We're knocking on doors every day, and also calling voters and phone banking. So I think our campaign has taken off as of recently. People are excited about someone from the district that is actually speaking about their lived experiences that they can relate to. I think that's very important. And so we're just going to keep at it and make sure that we're one of the candidates that will make it into this runoff. And I feel confident that we will be able to do so.
Nabila Islam, the website is Nabila for Congress. That is Nabila with an H at the end, forcongress.com. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nabila Islam is running for Congress in Georgia's 7th District. You can get more information about Nabila's campaign over at NabilaForCongress.com. N-A-B-I-L-A-H forCongress.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. We are continuing the Progressive Candidate Spotlight series, where we highlight progressive candidates who are challenging establishment Democrats. This week, we feature Hector Aceguera, who is running in New Jersey's 8th District. So, Hector, you're running in the New Jersey's 8th Congressional District. I know that's a fairly, I guess, well, not too new, but it's a relatively new congressional district, maybe about 12 years or so. Give us some sense of what that district is like.
Sure. So first and foremost, thank you for having me on, Sam. It's a pleasure. I'm running in the 8th district, and the best way to describe it is that it's the Hispanic gerrymander in New Jersey. So essentially, my district encompasses most of Hudson County, which is the area right across from Manhattan, Jersey City, Hoboken, a small city called West New York, as ironic as that is. Mm. And these towns have a large Hispanic population, and there are also a couple of random towns sort of cut into the district for the fact that they also have a fairly large Hispanic population, and that would be places like Elizabeth, Belleville, and Fairview. So really, the best way to describe my district is as the Hispanic gerrymander.
Interesting. And what's the give us a sense of the economic situation there. And before you do, maybe I'm just fascinated by that. What was the theory behind this? Is the idea that incumbent protection on both sides of the lines drawn?
So the district right next to mine is the 10th district, and that is the Black gerrymander. So there are certain towns in my district that are literally cut in half between the Black portions of those towns and the Hispanic portions of those towns. And that's essentially, I guess, under the most Machiavellian terms, is to pander to the local populace of those towns, is to say, okay, well, we'll throw you a bone by making sure that your racial group is forever protected and forever has a representative seat in government. And you know, I guess you can sort of try to see it under benevolent auspices, but in the way that it operates is absolutely Machiavellian and kind of disgusting from my perspective.
It does sound a little gross, frankly. With that said, you've got to run in that district. You get the district that you get. So, Hector, give us a sense of what are the concerns of folks in the 8th district?
All right, great. So the 8th district is very working class, a lot of immigrants, right? A lot of Hispanics. So there are a lot of people coming to the country, a lot of blue collar workers. So the main concerns are really these working class concerns around affordable housing. Affordable housing is absolutely non-existent in my district, mostly because of developers who have bribed the local politicians. They put up these really expensive high-rise buildings that essentially nobody in the district could afford to live in. So we're really importing very rich people from New York City who want to work in New York but live in New Jersey, and they'll come over and they'll buy these really expensive high-rise condos. A certain son-in-law to the current president has a building in Jersey City. I'm not sure if you get who I'm talking about,
yes,
but I'm sure you do.
I would imagine.
And he owns a high-rise, which is really emblematic of this problem. He puts up a high-rise on the waterfront of Jersey City. Absolutely nobody in our district could afford to live there. And I'm sure you'll recall there was a little bit of a scandal with them selling these million-dollar visas from Chinese investors.
Wow. And so we're talking about what appears to be a growing wealth inequality in that district, right? You have attempts at least some measure of gentrification to use your district as basically a commuter launching pad for the city. Yet the infrastructure and the daily lives of the people who are living in your district, it sounds like, is not improving because all the moneyed interests are just going into catering to wealthy Manhattan commuters.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. And that's absolutely the situation that we have in terms of housing, in terms of mass transit infrastructure, in terms of education. So my district has, at the same time, some of the best schools in the state and in the country, and also some of the worst schools in the state and in the country. And that really highlights how essentially the zip code where you're born can really determine your lot in life, which is something I was born to, you know, believe wasn't the case in America, that no matter where you were born, no matter who you were born to, you had an equal shot at being a successful individual and joining the middle class. But unfortunately, yes, because our local politicians are all they're on the take from the real estate developers, from the pharmaceutical lobbies, various other interests that are in control here in New Jersey, it's really becoming a state of the haves and the have-nots, where the haves essentially have everything, and everybody else is told to struggle over crumbs and fight each other over what should be shared prosperity.
So, Hector, give us a sense of your story, where you grew up. I'm over at your website at osegura2020.com, OSEGUERA2020.com. You grew up in Hoboken. Tell us, or I should say you were born in Hoboken. What else can you tell us about your time in the district?
I am a lifelong resident of the district, and I've been accused on more than one occasion of having a bubble and sort of being stuck to this district. I went away to Boston for undergrad. I studied poli-sci at Boston University, and I also got my law degree in Boston. But something always draws me back to the district, and it's really because that's where I feel at home. That's what I know as home. I was raised in that very tiny city of West New York, right? It's like the most ironic thing in the world. It is a 1 square mile city that is one of the most densely populated places in the entire country. And, you know, I had a regular working class upbringing. My mother's a teacher. My father did every job under the sun. He was a truck driver. He was a handyman. He was a plumber, an electrician. Anything that you can do with your hands coming to this country as an immigrant, he and my mother did to give me and my sister the best possible life we could have. And so that's really the basis from which I've sprung. And, you know, living here my entire life, I am not unfamiliar with the incumbent. He was actually my hometown mayor. His wife worked at my elementary school when I was a child. So I know these people, and I know how the system works. And essentially, it's a machine, right? The politics in New Jersey is really akin to something out of the 1800s with smoke-filled rooms, old fat guys with cigars deciding the destiny of everybody in their district. And that's really what I've lived under, is a very tightly controlled political situation where outsiders are not welcome. If you are not part of the good old boys club, you are essentially told to get in line and wait your turn, if you ever get a turn. And I just essentially got sick of it. People here, everybody deserves a shot. You know, this is a democracy, or so I've been told. This sort of like oligarchy that we live under is absolutely unjust. It stomps over people. It really takes advantage of everybody. A quick story I could share with you is that if you work in the public sector in my district, if you're a teacher, if you're a firefighter, if you are a crossing guard, if you work for the Board of Education or any public service employee, what you will come to find is that the local politicians come to you every election season and tell you that you have to canvass for the local politician. You have to go to galas for the local politician, where they essentially extort $100, $150, $175 donations from every public service employee in the district. And if you dare to fight back, you will find yourself unemployed. When I launched my campaign, I told one of my high school teachers about this campaign, and he said, you know what, Hector, I love you. You're a great guy. I know you would make a great congressman, but if I ever say anything in support of you, I'll be dumpster diving to feed my children. And, you know, that's not something most people are willing to risk.
All right. Hector Asaguirre, we're going to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with more on this challenge in the 8th Congressional District in New Jersey. Right back after this. So, Hector, in the last segment, you basically told us about the 8th Congressional District. You said it was a gerrymander where that basically was to create a safe Hispanic seat in New Jersey. This is a district that has enormous wealth disparity. Right across the river from New York City, it is becoming increasingly a commuter spot with high rises. Meanwhile, services for people who have been living in the district all their lives in some of the places are lacking. There's a lot of old boy network in New Jersey, a lot of like patronage, pay to play type of stuff. You're running against Albio Cires. Tell us a little bit about this Democrat that you're challenging in this district.
So, like I said, he was my hometown mayor when I was a kid, and he comes directly out of the New Jersey political scene. He's a Cuban refugee, and one of the reasons that I decided to run against him in this, you know, very tightly controlled district is that, like I said, it's a Hispanic gerrymander. And a couple months back, a wonderful group of activists went to his office and asked him something that I thought was very practical. You know, at the height of the immigrant detention center crisis, these activists organized, went to his office and said, not will you abolish ICE, which might be a great ask anyways, but they didn't even ask for that. They said, would you at least cut funding to ICE or at least stop the increase in funding to ICE, freeze the spending that is going to ICE? You know, in a Hispanic district where everybody's a Democrat, you would think that'd be something very practical to ask. But he said, absolutely not. He said, I will never vote to cut funding to ICE. ICE does great work. And again, that comes at the height of the immigrant detention center crisis. Yeah. And it was almost like a slap in the face of the people that he represents. On top of that, on Valentine's Day, I'm not sure if the name Elliot Abrams rings a bell to you.
It sure does.
But on Valentine's Day, my opponent takes a picture cozying up with Elliot Abrams.
Just to remind people. He was a Reagan official. He was also, during the Bush years, he was one in the State Department promoting war with Iraq. He was doing all sorts of horrible stuff in Central America in terms of death squads and whatnot. I mean, bad stuff.
So seminal trainer of death squads, pusher of regime change in Latin America, never found a war he didn't like, and is currently the Trump administration's main pusher of regime change in Venezuela. He was actually convicted for lying to Congress during Iran-Contra. So this is not a good guy. Not a good guy, and definitely not somebody that the people of my district would agree with, and definitely not someone that they'd like to see their congressman cozying up with. So that's essentially who I'm up against. He's a corporate Democrat, takes a ton of money from the pharmaceutical industry, and won't sign on to Pramila Jayapal's Medicare for All. He actually won't even say the words Medicare for All. For months, he has been ducking a group of climate change activists that want to ask him just his opinion on a Green New Deal, not any hard commitment, nothing crazy, nothing serious, just what do you think, and will not do it. He would not meet with them. He's never held a town hall in his entire term in Congress. He will never hold a town hall. He says that he'll never hold a town hall. You know, he's not really there when it comes to policy, the policies that would make our district a better place for the working class people that inhabit the district.
Hector, I got a two-part question. One is,
sure,
how is this guy getting reelected? And two, how do you defeat him? Like, what is it? Like, what is your strategy here?
Well, I'm glad you asked. So how does he keep getting reelected? That is a great question. So New Jersey, like I said, is a very tightly controlled political atmosphere. There's something called the county line, which I think you should do a little bit of looking into. I invite all the viewers to look into, but essentially it's a tool that the political machine or the political establishment uses to perpetuate themselves forever. It essentially lines up politicians from the local district or municipality level all the way up to the senator and up to the presidency. And around election time, you will see massive posters in the district that all it says is one letter, the letter A, vote line A. So another thing that the establishment does is that it maintains the line and it always gets line A. Even though the line is supposed to be randomly chosen, somehow the establishment types are constantly getting the first line that you see. So it's lined up in alphabetical order. So line A obviously is the first one you would
right.
see. And all you have to do is vote down the line from president down to your board of education. Vote line A. You'll see a lot of posters with no officials' names on them. If the names are there, they're very small. All you see is a huge letter A, vote line A. And that's constantly what people do. We call it inertia, because these are
right.
the people who have always been in charge, and they essentially plan to always be in charge using these sorts of tricks to get themselves, you know, it's a very sick psychological trick that is played on the voters. And there are activists who are now working in New Jersey to abolish the county line.
Right. It's a slate. It's, right. Of course. I mean, it gives you a huge advantage, ballot placement like this, and to have it just a sign off is, I mean, people do that with parties sometimes as well. All right. Well, so Hector Asagara,
yeah.
we just had about a minute and a half left. What's your strategy? How do you defeat that?
Okay, so how do we beat this machine? Honestly, it's not as big a pull as people think it is, because things have been so tightly controlled for so long, this machine projects strength that's not there. So we go out, we talk to people. I've been holding meet and greets all across the district, and the energy is absolutely tremendous. People are really excited to have another option. My opponent has never had a real challenger to his fiefdom. And so we are going out there, we're talking to people, getting out there in the streets and letting people know that there is an option this year, someone who's from the area, someone who knows what the issues are. And honestly, I think that there's a tremendous amount of energy, and I think that we can really pull this one off, and we can kick this machine in its backside.
There's a lot of similarities, it seems to me, between your race and AOC's race. Insofar as that you have maybe a overconfident incumbent who is relying on both like inertia, like you say, and a party apparatus that with enough people can be beaten. With 30 seconds left, I imagine one of the things you're looking for is volunteers. I'm looking at your Asagara2020.com website, and volunteer is even ahead of a contribute.
Yeah, so this is going to be a campaign that's grassroots and powered by people. So I invite all the listeners, everybody in America, to check out Asagara2020.com and sign up to volunteer. We will take all the help we can get, And we're definitely, you know, relying on that grassroots energy to carry us across this finish line. Just really quickly, you said that there are some similarities between me and AOC, and I would harp on that ad infinitum. So I went to BU at the same time that AOC did. I volunteered for her congressional campaign. A lot of the people who gave me early advice were volunteers and people who worked on her congressional campaign. And if you check out 538, they do a district analysis of demographics, and the district closest to mine is New York 14, which is her. Yeah, so there are a lot of similarities there. I would never, you know, shy away from drawing comparisons to AOC, and I really do believe that the emphasis is there for someone to, you know, take out this corporate Democrat who absolutely does not represent the district.
Hector Oseguera, OSEGUERA 2020.com. Yep. Hector, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. I really appreciate you having me on.
Hector Oseguera is running for Congress in New Jersey's 8th District. You can find out more about Hector's campaign over at Oseguera, O-S-E-G-U-E-R-A, 2020.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. We're continuing our Progressive Candidate Spotlight, where we highlight progressive candidates who are challenging the establishment in the Democratic Party. This week, Andum Ghebreyesus, who is running in New York's 16th district against longtime incumbent Elliot Engel. So, Andum, you are running in the 16th district in New York. You're challenging Representative Elliot Engel, longtime Democratic congressman. We should also say that you're running in a primary that includes Jamal Bowman. We have interviewed Jamal on this program. Give us your sense of the 16th district in New York. What can you tell us about this district?
Yeah, well, it's a pretty fascinating district. It's extremely socioeconomically and racially diverse. You have the northern parts of the district, which includes some of the most affluent parts of the country, Scarsdale, Ardsley, Hastings, and also within Westchester is my hometown, Mount Vernon, which up until a couple of years ago, it was one of only five cities in America where the median black income was higher than the median white income. We also, in this district, it stretches across two counties, Bronx and Westchester County. So within the Bronx, we have the Northwest Bronx, which includes Riverdale, you know, relatively affluent, pretty diverse. Then the Northeast Bronx, areas like Wakefield, Williamsbridge, Baychester, which are heavily Caribbean, first, second generation American and immigrant population.
This sounds like an incredibly diverse district, and has it changed over the years? I mean, I'm curious as to, you know, where Engel's strength comes from, or are we looking at a situation where, in some respects, maybe the district has evolved over the years, and there's been a lot of inertia that has kept Engel in?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both, to be honest. You know, the district is majority people of color, between 60-65% people of color, and that is more than it was, you know, when Engel first got in office in 1989. You know, he does have some strongholds in Riverdale and in some parts of northern Westchester, but it really is the inertia that you were speaking about. There's about 9.7-9.8% of people turned out in the last election in 2018. So you have a vast majority of people who are not even engaged in the political process, who are not even aware of what Representative Engel is doing for the district. And so part of our efforts in this campaign is to be able to engage parts of the community which have not been engaged. It's to mobilize people and hopefully get that number closer to about 13-14%.
Okay, so give us a sense of Engel. I mean, you're challenging. We're doing this series. There's a lot of primary challenges this year of sitting Democratic congresspeople, a lot coming from the left. And frankly, those are the ones we're interested in. Give us a sense of where Engel in your mind is out of step with where the party is headed, or where he's out of step with your district.
Definitely. I, you know, like many of the Democratic establishment, Elliot Engel takes corporate money and is beholden to special interests. But I think really the main thing that distinguishes Elliot Engel from a lot of the other Democrats that we see in Congress is, as chair of House Foreign Affairs, he is one of the most militaristic and hawkish Democrats that we have in Congress. And that is really one of the things that actually motivated me to run and jump in this race. I was a special education teacher in New York City. And when I taught in the Bronx, you know, my 11-year-old students had to walk through metal detectors up three flights to a floor that was crammed with 500 students where there was only one social worker. And myself as a first-year teacher, I had to pay for paper to give my kids worksheets. So we were severely lacking funds in our school. Yet Elliot Engel, as someone who's been there for 30 years, has always been willing to fund military adventures in the Middle East, which we know have really been destructive for countries in the Middle East as well as to our own soldiers. Elliot Engel voted for the Iraq War in 2003 when I was in high school marching against it. He voted for against withdrawing troops from Afghanistan in 2011, contributed about $45 billion a year to the war over there. And he's also been always willing to give military aid to many countries that have committed human rights abuses. So not only is it a financial and fiscal thing, which is problematic when we consider how underserved parts of our district are, but it's also a moral issue. And that's really why I'm in the race.
It's fascinating because you don't hear, and Engel is somebody who I think, I mean, I agree with your assessment in terms of where he is on foreign policy. I think it's a real problem. There is a segment of the Democratic Party that is incredibly hawkish. And this is a time where we're going to have to come in and repair a lot of damage that has been done over the course of the past 4 years. Hopefully it can be done. Give me a little bit of sense of your background. You said you were a special education teacher. It's fascinating to me. Both of his challengers in this district, Engels, are educators. I mean, what do you think?
He himself is an educator.
So what is that about? I mean, is that just a coincidence, or is there a relationship that you have with, I don't know, the community because you're a teacher, that in some way informs your desire to run and get full on in public service in this way?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I mean, I think it's just a crazy coincidence that there are three educators in the race. Particularly even with me and Jamal, black male educators are 2% of the entire teaching population. So it's a really crazy coincidence that we're both in it. But in terms of being a special education teacher, I think it directly leads to the type of progressive thinking, which is what we need in office right now. You know, as a special education teacher, the type of pedagogy we're taught is around being able to make curriculum accessible to neurodiverse individuals, to students who have been shut out of the traditional classroom. And so a lot of what we do is, again, sort of widening the base and widening the foundation for our students in a similar way that I think progressives are attempting to do that with society and the welfare state right now. But moreover, you know, just teachers in general, you know, we have to interact with so many diverse stakeholders in order to ensure that our students are developing academically, are developing socially, are on the pathways to success. You know, we have to engage with not only the students themselves, but their parents, their families, their coaches, people in the community who are influential with them, whether it be religious leaders or whoever it is. So, you know, we're just always engaging with diverse stakeholders, and I think that's a natural transition into Congress. But, you know, to be honest, for me, this was never like a plan I had 10 years ago when I started teaching. The reason why I'm here is because of the exigencies that we're facing in our community and the fact that Representative Engel is not appropriately dealing with them.
It's fascinating. All right. Well, I want to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the issues a little bit more. I mean, you've talked about your interest in foreign policy and want to talk a little bit about your background growing up in Mount Vernon. You had almost an equally diverse, I think, experience growing up as the district represents in many respects. And let's talk about that. I'm going to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm talking to Ondam Aguirre-Brigugis, and we'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. We're continuing our progressive candidate spotlight where we highlight progressive candidates who are challenging the establishment in the Democratic Party. This week, Andem Ghebreyesus, who is running in New York's 16th district against longtime incumbent Elliot Engel. So, Andem, you are running in the 16th district in New York. You're challenging Representative Elliot Engel, longtime Democratic congressman. We should also say that you're running in a primary that includes Jamal Bowman. We have interviewed Jamal on this program. Give us your sense of the 16th district in New York. What can you tell us about this district?
Yeah, well, it's a pretty fascinating district. It's extremely socioeconomically and racially diverse. You have the northern parts of the district, which includes some of the most affluent parts of the country, Scarsdale, Ardsley, Hastings, and also within Westchester is my hometown, Mount Vernon, which up until a couple of years ago was one of only five cities in America where the median black income was higher than the median white income. We also, in this district, it stretches across two counties, Bronx and Westchester County. So within the Bronx, we have the Northwest Bronx, which includes Riverdale, relatively affluent, pretty diverse. Then the Northeast Bronx areas like Wakefield, Williamsbridge, Baychester, which are heavily Caribbean, first, second generation American and immigrant population.
This sounds like an incredibly diverse district, and has it changed over the years? I mean, I'm curious as to, you know, where Engel's strength comes from, or are we looking at a situation where, in some respects, maybe the district has evolved over the years, and there's been a lot of inertia that has kept Engel in?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both, to be honest. You know, the district is majority people of color, between 60-65% people of color, and that is more than it was, when Engel first got in office in 1989. You know, he does have some strongholds in Riverdale and in some parts of northern Westchester, but it really is the inertia that you were speaking about. There's about 9.8% of people turned out in the last election in 2018. So you have a vast majority of people who are not even engaged in the political process, who are not even aware of what Representative Engel is doing for the district. And so part of our efforts in this campaign is to be able to engage parts of the community which have not been engaged. It's to mobilize people and hopefully get that number closer to about 13-14%.
Okay, so give us a sense of Engel. I mean, you're challenging. We're doing this series. There's a lot of primary challenges this year of sitting Democratic congresspeople, a lot coming from the left. And frankly, those are the ones we're interested in. Give us a sense of, where Engel in your mind is out of step with where the party is headed, or where he's out of step with your district.
Definitely. Like many of the Democratic establishment, Elliot Engel takes corporate money and is beholden to special interests. But I think really the main thing that distinguishes Elliot Engel from a lot of the other Democrats that we see in Congress is, as chair of House Foreign Affairs, he is one of the most militaristic and hawkish Democrats that we have in Congress. And that is really one of the things that actually motivated me to run and jump in this race. I was a special education teacher in New York City, and when I taught in the Bronx, you know, my 11-year-old students had to walk through metal detectors up three flights to a floor that was crammed with 500 students where there was only one social worker. And myself, as a first-year teacher, I had to pay for paper to give my kids worksheets. So we were severely lacking funds in our school, yet Elliot Engel, as someone who's been there for 30 years, has always been willing to fund military adventures in the Middle East, which we know have really been destructive for countries in the Middle East as well as to our own soldiers. Elliot Engel voted for the Iraq War in 2003 when I was in high school marching against it. He voted withdrawing troops from Afghanistan in 2011, contributed about $45 billion a year to the war over there. And he's also been always willing to give military aid to many countries that have committed human rights abuses. So not only is it a financial and fiscal thing, which is problematic when we consider how underserved parts of our district are, but it's also a moral issue. And then that's really why I'm in the race.
It's fascinating because you don't hear, and Engel is somebody who I think, I mean, I agree with your assessment in terms of where he is on foreign policy. I think it's a real problem. There is a segment of the Democratic Party that is incredibly hawkish, and this is a time where we're going to have to come in and repair a lot of damage that has been done over the course of the past 4 years. Hopefully it can be done. Give me a little bit of sense of your background. You said you were a special education teacher. It's fascinating to me. Both of his challengers in this district, Engels, are educators. I mean, what do you think?
He himself is an educator.
Oh, so what is that about? I mean, is that just a coincidence, or is there a relationship that you have with, I don't know, the community because you're a teacher, that in some way informs your desire to run and get full on in public service in this way?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I mean, I think it's just a crazy coincidence that there are three educators in the race. Particularly even with me and Jamal, black male educators are 2% of the entire teaching population. So it's a really crazy coincidence that we're both in it. But in terms of being a special education teacher, I think it directly leads to the type of progressive thinking, which is what we need in office right now. You know, as a special education teacher, the type of pedagogy we're taught is around being able to make curriculum accessible to neurodiverse individuals, to students who have been shut out of the traditional classroom. And so a lot of what we do is, again, sort of widening the base and widening the foundation for our students in a similar way that I think progressives are attempting to do that with society and the welfare state right now. But moreover, you know, just teachers in general, you know, we have to interact with so many diverse stakeholders in order to ensure that our students are developing academically, are developing socially, are on the pathways to success. You know, we have to engage with not only the students themselves, but their parents, their families, their coaches, people in the community who are influential with them, whether it be religious leaders or whoever it is. So, you know, we're just always engaging with diverse stakeholders, and I think that's a natural transition into Congress. But, you know, to be honest, for me, this was never like a plan I had 10 years ago when I started teaching. The reason why I'm here is because of the exigencies that we're facing in our community and the fact that Representative Engel is not appropriately dealing with them.
It's fascinating. All right. Well, I want to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the issues a little bit more. I mean, you've talked about your interest in foreign policy and want to talk a little bit about your background growing up in Mount Vernon. You had almost an equally diverse, I think, experience growing up as the district represents in many respects. And let's talk about that. I'm going to take a quick break. I'm Sam Seder. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm talking to Ondam Aguirre-Brigugis, and we'll be right back after this. So, Ondam, in the last segment, you basically outlined one of the reasons why you were running, or one of the primary reasons why you're running against Elliot Engel, and you told us about your experience as a special needs teacher in New York City and how their skills that you develop and sensitivities, I think, that you develop that lead you and push you into a desire to represent the 16th district. We talked about how diverse a district it is. And is it first generation of immigrant parents?
Exactly. Yeah.
And you had a very sort of a varied experience growing up in that district.
Yeah, definitely. I grew up in Mount Vernon, which I mentioned before is a very diverse city. I went to a Jewish Y growing up that was 50% black and a couple blocks away from where Betty Shabazz lived. So like that just like sort of highlights the diversity of the community. But, you know, I went to a public school that was a blue ribbon school, great public school. The middle schools in Mount Vernon when I was growing up are not as good as the elementary schools. So my teachers encouraged me to apply to the private schools in Riverdale, in a more affluent area in the district. And I ended up transitioning to a school in Riverdale for middle school called Fieldston, which, was a very expensive private school. I now was only one of you know, six or seven people of color. And even more so than racially, it was really a huge class difference that I was made aware of. I had always been aware of sort of the international differences in class and socioeconomic status because my parents were from Eritrea and I had visited Eritrea and I could tell the difference between Eritrea and America. But I'd never really seen at that point in my life, you know, just the difference between Mount Vernon and this area of Riverdale. So that really just awoken me at that time to the stark class differences that existed only within a couple miles apart.
So, Ondem, I am at ondem4newyork.com, your website, ANDOM4NY.com. And looking over your issue set, foreign policy for the people, we spoke about that briefly in the last segment. Tell us from a priority perspective, which of these, I mean, you're listing a lot of the progressive policies that we talk about. Housing, I see, is up there. What are the priorities?
Yeah, you know, so I think all of these issues are intersectional, and to be honest, they're internationalist in the sense that we can't distinguish them from what's going on around the world. So it's not necessarily that there are specific individual policies that are priorities, but we have a priority of securing economic justice. And how do we secure economic justice? Well, we have to support a homes guarantee, a federal jobs guarantee, single-payer Medicare for all, fully funding education, increasing union density. You know, we support dismantling the military-industrial complex and being able to pursue the necessary multilateralism and diplomatic engagement for a global Green New Deal. So, you know, everything that we have on the site is really interrelated. So there are certain priorities that we have in terms of the end goal and the humanizing mission that we have, like I said, securing racial justice or the global Green New Deal and the multilateralism required for it. But it's not specifically just like, oh, it's only foreign policy. Oh, it's only LGBTQ rights. All of these things are interrelated.
What most animates you? I mean, I think that obviously we need a large push. But when you anticipate being seated as a congressperson from the 16th district, if they give you a choice of committees, which committee are you going to gravitate towards?
Yeah, you know, I think just because of my own experience as a professional and also as an activist, I think it would have to be education and labor or foreign affairs. I think just because of my background, that's where I would lean towards.
What are the biggest challenges to labor, do you think, in this country?
Oh, my God. I mean, you know, if we just look at how union density has declined over the last 40 years. I mean, it's a huge issue. It's one of the things that has contributed to wage stagnation and the fact that income inequality is at the highest point it's been in 50 years. So, you know, when we're talking about things like the PRO Act, repealing Taft-Hartley 14B.
Tell folks what the PRO Act is. I'm not sure that everybody's familiar with it.
Yeah, so Protecting the Right to Organize Act is an important bill that is in the House that would ensure that workers have the right to organize, that their ability for first contract negotiations aren't denied, prevents against union busting, prevents against right to work for less, and it's something that is essential, really, to being able to guarantee that workers have the right to organize in unions and guarantee their bargaining power. And we've seen that when union density is increased, and New York actually has the second highest union membership rate in the country. It's about double that of the national average, which is 10%. In New York, it's about 20%. When you see that wages are higher, that inequality is lessened, and that should be an ultimate goal that we have.
Well, what do you make of the teachers have been some of the most active over the past couple of years in terms of using their labor as a lever? Some trace it back to the Chicago teachers strike in 2011, I think it was. And then, of course, we had the Red State Revolt in 2018. where we saw teachers in red states across the country that didn't even have unions per se, more like associations, if you will, rise up against states that were cutting their budgets, particularly on behalf of their students. Give me your sense as to why teachers have been sort of the vanguard of a resurgent labor movement.
You know, so I think this is, it's twofold. I think part of it is that teachers are on the front lines of seeing what public disinvestment and privatization of education, how that affects not only their students, but how it affects them and their ability to organize and advocate for themselves as workers and for their students. So I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is that we see that, you know, in so many states, public sector workers don't have the right to organize. So we're seeing the contradiction that is existing within the classroom, and the classroom as a site of labor negotiation and a site of labor contestation. But at the same time, teachers aren't able to effectively organize. In six southern states, I believe that public school teachers aren't able to form a union. So that's one of the reasons why we support the Public Sector Freedom to Negotiate Act, and why it's very important that all public sector workers, but teachers in particular, have the right to organize.
So on to, there's a template out there for unseating sitting Democratic congresspeople who have been longtime congresspeople. Obviously, AOC, that formula, there's attempt across the country, I think, to replicate it in many respects. What's it going to take for you to win this district, or this primary, I should say?
Yeah, so, you know, we've had the good fortune of any time we've been able to get in front of people and speak about our campaign, get people on the website, and they can see our fully-fledged platform and vision, folks tend to be very excited. The challenge is being able to get out there to as many Democrats in the district as possible. So we've had a good fortune, again, as I said, of when people are seeing us, the message tends to resonate with them. And through that, we've been able to build a pretty strong volunteer base that is going out in all different parts of the district and communicating with people. I'm pretty lucky in that I have so many students, former students actually, who are really excited about the campaign and have been very, very active in going door to door and engaging with people in the district. We also were very serendipitously, I was featured in Humans of New York about 3 weeks ago, which really, you know, sort of blew up the campaign, and it was basically broadcast on social media to close to 30 million people about what we're trying to do. So that really just doubled our volunteer base that we already had, which was pretty strong. So really it's just about sort of what you were saying. You know, we just have to go door to door, engage with as many people as possible. The district here is, the median age is a little bit older than AOC's district. So just being able to get in front of people and engage with them directly, it has a huge, huge impact.
Andam Yibergorgis, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Great to be on. Thanks so much.
Andam Yibergorgis is running for Congress in New York's 16th District. You can find out more about Andam's campaign over at andam4ny.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. We're continuing our Progressive Candidate Spotlight, where we highlight progressive candidates who are challenging the establishment, Democratic or Republican. This week we feature Andrew Romanoff, who is running for Senate in Colorado. So, Andrew, let's just get to the nuts and bolts of it. Let's start with why you're running. Your race, obviously a primary, hopefully to face Cory Gardner. Yours, Colorado is, if the Democrats are going to take the Senate, Colorado is going to be one of the first, or it has to be one of the first seats that they take in this effort. So just give us a sense of why you're running, and then we'll take it from there.
Well, you're right. There is no path to a Democratic majority in the Senate that doesn't run through Colorado. Cory's considered one of the, if not the most vulnerable Republicans in the Senate. And I'm running because I'm not content to stand by while more people in the richest nation on the face of the earth struggle or suffer or die on account of problems we can fix. We need a senator who will treat the climate crisis like the emergency it is and end our reliance on fossil fuels. We need somebody who has battled the insurance industry, as I've done for the last 4 years as the president of a mental health organization, and we'll make sure we get a plan of comprehensive coverage for all Americans that doesn't depend on their job or the whims of an insurance company. We need to build an economy that works for everyone. We need to end this epidemic of gun violence, and we need to reform our broken immigration system. And on every single one of those issues, Cory Gardner is part of the problem.
Okay, and so give us a sense. Now, you're running in a primary, so the first order of business is going to be to get the Democratic nomination. Why you?
Well, I've got the strongest record of legislative leadership in this race and was recognized as one of the most effective legislative leaders in America. I led the Democrats here in Colorado to our first majority in 30 years, our first back-to-back majorities since the 1960s. I have earned endorsements now from nearly 350 state and local officials across Colorado, 10 times as many endorsements as all the other candidates combined. And frankly, I'm not the darling of Washington. I think that's an advantage. Coloradans want to know that you're willing to stand up to your own party when your conscience or your constituents demand it, just like Cory Gardner promised and failed to do. And the truth is the national party isn't always right. We've seen and learned the hard way what happens when you allow corporate cash to contaminate both political parties in Washington. It's one of the reasons we haven't gotten the aggressive climate action we need. One of the reasons I'm running on a platform that includes a Green New Deal. One of the reasons I've earned the endorsement of the Sunrise Movement, among other environmental activists.
I take it in terms of the priorities of Coloradans, obviously the environment is up there. How does that play into this primary?
It's a real point of division in this race, not just between Cory Gardner and me, but also between our former governor. John Hickenlooper, as you may know, got recruited into this race by Chuck Schumer and the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, even though Hick said he didn't want the job and wouldn't be good at it. I happen to believe him. And he has acquired a record that is not consistent with the kind of aggressive climate action we need. In fact, he sued communities in Colorado that tried to restrict fracking and protect their public health. He literally drank the fracking fluid. He refused to sign the No Fossil Fuel Money pledge that I've signed. Not only opposes the Green New Deal, he describes progressive priorities like that as, and these are his words, the discredited ideas of Karl Marx and Joseph Stalin. I expected we'd have to fight Republicans like Cory Gardner. I didn't realize we'd have to fight Democrats who are parroting their talking points.
I mean, I guess, obviously I'm not from Colorado. The perspectives of Coloradans probably different from mine. But as a progressive, and I look at a guy like Hickenlooper, who is, like you say, the darling of Chuck Schumer and some in the wing, I would say probably the more corporatist wing of the Democratic Party in some respects. I guess my concern, and I want to get your take on this, is that when a guy like Hickenlooper gets the backing of the infrastructure of the Democrats in the Senate, he's going to want the opportunity. There's going to be gives and gets back and forth. And, I know that there isn't sort of like a broad acceptance of a very aggressive climate change, program across the Democrats. Where does that come in? I mean, when they start to horse trade like that, I mean, you've been in a legislature. You have an understanding of these dynamics. Where does Coloradans end on that exchange?
Well, Coloradans end up holding the bag. There's a report out just recently that shows we have some of the worst air pollution in the country. It's in large part the product of the runaway oil and gas production and consumption that Governor Hickenlooper presided over. And you're right, this aggressive approach that we're taking to the climate emergency. And in fact, we put a very provocative ad on our website at AndrewRomanoff.com if you want to see the stakes. That doesn't sit well with the Schumer crowd or their corporate benefactors. You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist, right, Sam? I mean, you can follow the money and figure out pretty quickly why we haven't taken the climate action we need or made the kind of health care reforms that we need. It's in large part because the lawmakers who are supposed to be regulating those industries instead are subsidized by them. It's all pay to play, and we're paying the price.
I mean, one of the things that we saw when the Democrats took over the House was Nancy Pelosi immediately trying to shut down this notion of a Green New Deal. And if the Democrats get the Senate back, what's the opportunity? How does that change the pressure on the House to start to accept that if we have enough, frankly, senators like yourself who are prioritizing something like this?
Well, you hit the nail on the head there, Sam, right? It's not enough just to take a majority, although that's key, to hold the House, to flip the Senate, to take the White House. I would argue also to kill the filibuster, which is blocking progress on a lot of these fronts. But we got to make sure that we elect Democrats who bring the courage of our convictions to Washington. And frankly, I take a lot of inspiration from the young folks who are leading this charge. For example, the Sunrise Movement, which, as I mentioned, has endorsed my campaign, has done more to address this climate crisis than most of the adults were paying in Washington. I turned to one of the young people who was leading this charge, and I expressed my admiration. And he turned to me and he said, "Well, no kidding, Grandpa." I mean, he didn't actually say Grandpa. That was just the sentiment. He said, "We're going to be here a lot longer than you are." And I think young people understand that. And it's one of the reasons that we need them to put pressure on the folks in Washington, because this change is not going to come from D.C. on its own.
I want to start talking a little bit about what's happening with Cory Gardner. But you brought up the filibuster. And I think there are senators who, in many respects, they try and position themselves in the middle of the Senate as a way of making them the power brokers, where they are representing their own interests for power. I mean, this has just been my observation over the years. They represent themselves and try and put themselves, and if that means thwarting a Democratic majority, they will do that to be the guy that, controls the power. Right? There's several candidates for who those people are going to be in the Senate as they are now. Getting rid of the filibuster strengthens the hand, obviously, of the Democrats, because it means that they need less of these people on board. Where do you see, what other reforms do you think needs to happen with the Senate? Are you worried about getting rid of the filibuster?
No, and I'll tell you why. I led the House of Representatives in Colorado for 4 years. I was the Speaker of the House here. We don't have a filibuster in the State House or the State Senate. We take up or down votes on bills. One of the reforms, to answer your question, that I would support would be the one that Colorado adopted years ago that says you can't allow the Speaker of the House or the Majority Leader or President of the Senate to just pocket bills that he or she doesn't like. Every bill in Colorado gets a hearing or a vote. The same should be true in the U.S. Senate. Instead of allowing Mitch McConnell to act like a tyrant, he calls himself the Grim Reaper of the Senate and takes it as a compliment. Another reform I'd support: Colorado has passed a sunshine law that says any meeting between two or more lawmakers on an issue of public policy has to be open to the public and the press. So you can't cobble together these backroom deals and the dark of night where nobody is around except the lobbyists and the politicians who are cutting those deals in the first place. I think Colorado has a lot to teach Washington about how to make the legislative process more accountable and more transparent.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment with the senatorial primary candidate Andrew Romanoff in Colorado. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire. When we come back, we're going to talk a couple more of these issues that Andrew supports. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. We're continuing our Progressive Candidate Spotlight, where we highlight progressive candidates who are challenging the establishment, Democratic or Republican. This week, we feature Andrew Romanoff, who is running for Senate in Colorado. So, Andrew, let's just get to the nuts and bolts of it. Let's start with why you're running. Your race, obviously a primary, hopefully to face Cory Gardner. Yours, Colorado is, if the Democrats are going to take the Senate, Colorado is going to be one of the first, or it has to be one of the first seats that they take in this effort. So just give us a sense of why you're running, and then we'll take it from there.
Well, you're right. There is no path to a Democratic majority in the Senate that doesn't run through Colorado. Cory's considered one of the, if not the most vulnerable Republicans in the Senate. And I'm running because I'm not content to stand by while more people in the richest nation on the face of the earth struggle or suffer or die on account of problems we can fix. We need a senator who will treat the climate crisis like the emergency it is and end our reliance on fossil fuels. We need somebody who has battled the insurance industry, as I've done for the last 4 years as the president of a mental health organization, and we'll make sure we get a plan of comprehensive coverage for all Americans that doesn't depend on their job or the whims of an insurance company. We need to build an economy that works for everyone. We need to end this epidemic of gun violence, and we need to reform our broken immigration system. And on every single one of those issues, Cory Gardner is part of the problem.
Okay, and so give us a sense. Now, you're running in a primary, so the first order of business is going to be to get the Democratic nomination. Why you?
Well, I've got the strongest record of legislative leadership in this race and was recognized as one of the most effective legislative leaders in America. I led the Democrats here in Colorado to our first majority in 30 years, our first back-to-back majorities since the 1960s. I have earned endorsements now from nearly 350 state and local officials across Colorado, 10 times as many endorsements as all the other candidates combined. And frankly, I'm not the darling of Washington. I think that's an advantage. Coloradans want to know that you're willing to stand up to your own party when your conscience or your constituents demand it, just like Cory Gardner promised and failed to do. And the truth is the national party isn't always right. We've seen and learned the hard way what happens when you allow corporate cash to contaminate both political parties in Washington. It's one of the reasons we haven't gotten the aggressive climate action we need. One of the reasons I'm running on a platform that includes a Green New Deal. One of the reasons I've earned the endorsement of the Sunrise Movement, among other environmental activists.
I take it in terms of the priorities of Coloradans, obviously the environment is up there. How does that play into this primary?
It's a real point of division in this race, not just between Cory Gardner and me, but also between our former governor. John Hickenlooper, as you may know, got recruited into this race by Chuck Schumer and the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, even though Hick said he didn't want the job and wouldn't be good at it. I happen to believe him. And he has acquired a record that is not consistent with the kind of aggressive climate action we need. In fact, he sued communities in Colorado that tried to restrict fracking and protect their public health. He literally drank the fracking fluid. He refused to sign the No Fossil Fuel Money pledge that I've signed. Not only opposes the Green New Deal, he describes progressive priorities like that as, and these are his words, the discredited ideas of Karl Marx and Joseph Stalin. I expected we'd have to fight Republicans like Cory Gardner. I didn't realize we'd have to fight Democrats who are parroting their talking points.
I mean, I guess, obviously I'm not from Colorado. The perspectives of Coloradans probably different from mine. But as a progressive, and I look at a guy like Hickenlooper, who is, like you say, the darling of Chuck Schumer and some in the wing, I would say probably the more corporatist wing of the Democratic Party in some respects. I guess my concern, and I want to get your take on this, is that when a guy like Hickenlooper gets the backing of the infrastructure of the Democrats in the Senate, he's going to want the opportunity. There's going to be gives and gets back and forth. And, I know that there isn't sort of like a broad acceptance of a very aggressive climate change, program across the Democrats. Where does that come in? I mean, when they start to horse trade like that, I mean, you've been in a legislature. You have an understanding of these dynamics. Where does Coloradans end on that exchange?
Well, Coloradans end up holding the bag. There's a report out just recently that shows we have some of the worst air pollution in the country. It's in large part the product of the runaway oil and gas production and consumption that Governor Hickenlooper presided over. And you're right, this aggressive approach that we're taking to the climate emergency. And in fact, we put a very provocative ad on our website at AndrewRomanoff.com if you want to see the stakes. That doesn't sit well with the Schumer crowd or their corporate benefactors. You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist, right, Sam? I mean, you can follow the money and figure out pretty quickly why we haven't taken the climate action we need or made the kind of healthcare reforms that we need. It's in large part because the lawmakers who are supposed to be regulating those industries instead are subsidized by them. It's all pay to play, and we're paying the price.
I mean, one of the things that we saw when the Democrats took over the House was Nancy Pelosi immediately trying to shut down this notion of a Green New Deal. And if the Democrats get the Senate back, what's the opportunity? How does that change the pressure on the House to start to accept that if we have enough, frankly, senators like yourself who are prioritizing something like this?
Well, you hit the nail on the head there, Sam, right? It's not enough just to take a majority, although that's key, to hold the House, to flip the Senate, to take the White House. I would argue also to kill the filibuster, which is blocking progress on a lot of these fronts. But we got to make sure that we elect Democrats who bring the courage of our convictions to Washington. And frankly, I take a lot of inspiration from the young folks who are leading this charge. For example, the Sunrise Movement, which, as I mentioned, has endorsed my campaign, has done more to address this climate crisis than most of the adults were paying in Washington. I turned to one of the young people who was leading this charge, and I expressed my admiration. And he turned to me and he said, "Well, no kidding, Grandpa." I mean, he didn't actually say Grandpa. That was just the sentiment. He said, "We're going to be here a lot longer than you are." And I think young people understand that. And it's one of the reasons that we need them to put pressure on the folks in Washington, because this change is not going to come from D.C. on its own.
I want to start talking a little bit about what's happening with Cory Gardner. But you brought up the filibuster. And I think there are senators who, in many respects, they try and position themselves in the middle of the Senate as a way of making them the power brokers, where they are representing their own interests for power. I mean, this has just been my observation over the years. They represent themselves and try and put themselves, and if that means thwarting a Democratic majority, they will do that to be the guy that, controls the power. Right? There's several candidates for who those people are going to be in the Senate as they are now. Getting rid of the filibuster strengthens the hand, obviously, of the Democrats, because it means that they need less of these people on board. Where do you see, what other reforms do you think needs to happen with the Senate? Are you worried about getting rid of the filibuster?
No, and I'll tell you why. I led the House of Representatives in Colorado for 4 years. I was the Speaker of the House here. We don't have a filibuster in the State House or the State Senate. We take up or down votes on bills. One of the reforms, to answer your question, that I would support would be the one that Colorado adopted years ago that says you can't allow the Speaker of the House or the Majority Leader or President of the Senate to just pocket bills that he or she doesn't like. Every bill in Colorado gets a hearing or a vote. The same should be true in the U.S. Senate. Instead of allowing Mitch McConnell to act like a tyrant, he calls himself the Grim Reaper of the Senate and takes it as a compliment. Another reform I'd support: Colorado has passed a sunshine law that says any meeting between two or more lawmakers on an issue of public policy has to be open to the public and the press. So you can't cobble together these backroom deals in the dark of night where nobody is around except the lobbyists and the politicians who are cutting those deals in the first place. I think Colorado has a lot to teach Washington about how to make the legislative process more accountable and more transparent.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment with the senatorial primary candidate Andrew Romanoff in Colorado. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire. When we come back, we're going to talk a couple more of these issues that Andrew supports. We'll be right back after this. So, Andrew, as you've mentioned, that climate change, obviously a huge priority for you, and obviously the clock is ticking, and certainly from Colorado. There really is few places in the country, I think, where we don't begin to see the implications of this. But, of course, we're seeing it all around the world. You also have, as one of your priorities listed on AndrewRomanoff.com, is ensuring health care for all. Where are you in the spectrum of the various plans that we hear, particularly in the context of the presidential election? What plan do you support? Is there legislation that's been introduced in either body that you support at this point? What is your theory of the case?
Yes, I support Medicare for all, and I'll tell you what I mean and why. One, I think we ought to strengthen Medicare by adding some benefits that aren't covered now, like dental and vision and hearing and long-term care. And two, I think we ought to lower the age of Medicare eligibility to zero, which was part of the proponent's original plan. If you go back to 1965 when LBJ signed Medicare and Medicaid into law, the idea then wasn't that you would stop with seniors, giving them the security of healthcare that can never be taken away, although I'm glad we got there. It was instead to extend that same protection to all Americans. I support this plan in part, Sam, because of the experience I've had battling the insurance industry. I spent 4 years as the president of Mental Health Colorado, the state's leading advocate on behalf of families, frankly, like mine, who have suffered from mental illness or drug addiction or experienced suicide. And I'll tell you one quick story. I know it's easy to get lost in a conversation about the 28 million Americans who are uninsured, or the 44 million who are underinsured, or the 500,000 families who go bankrupt each year because they can't afford their medical bills. I met a dad whose son had deep depression and then experienced a bout of psychosis. He needed treatment. His dad's insurance plan was supposed to cover it. Most plans, in fact, by law, are required to provide equal coverage for mental and physical care. But when the dad submitted a claim, the insurance company said no. So the dad appealed the decision, and the company said no. This went on for months until his son killed himself at the age of 14. 3 weeks later, his dad got a letter in the mail from the insurance company reversing its decision and agreeing to cover his late son's treatment. So I will just tell you, Sam, speaking not as a candidate, but as a human being, it is really painful for me to have conversations with moms and dads who have lost their kids, not just to a disease that we can treat, but also to the indifference of an industry that bases its profits on its ability to exclude as many sick people and deny as many claims as possible. That's the business model. And it's a great model if you're an insurance company. It's a pretty lousy model for the rest of us.
What's your sense of the ability, like how rapidly we could move to a system like that?
I think reasonable people can differ on how quickly we can get there, but we got to put the plan on the table. That's the point. It wasn't on the table, as you know, when the debate over the Affordable Care Act began 10 years ago. Even the public option, which was advanced fairly timidly, got sacrificed in those negotiations. You shouldn't begin the negotiations at the 50-yard line. That's one of the lessons I take from my experience as Speaker of the House. So you're never going to get this plan if you don't actually put it out there. And I think we can get from here to there in part by recognizing that what we're doing now doesn't work. I mean, healthcare costs are the single biggest source of bankruptcy in the United States. We're seeing something like 35,000 people in this nation die each year because they can't afford to see a doctor or a healthcare provider. And we're spending, as you know, twice as much as our competitors on healthcare that's not actually twice as good. Our life expectancy isn't longer, our infant or maternal mortality rates aren't lower. We're just leading the world in spending.
How do you respond to Hickenlooper, who, if you face in the general, will claim that you are you're going to outlaw private health insurance for folks? What's the response for that?
Well, I'd say a few things. I have not met a lot of families in Colorado who tell me, please don't touch my Anthem or my United or my Cigna. Folks say, please make sure that my doctor, my specialist is covered, and all of them would be, right, under a plan of Medicare for all those providers would be participating in the system. I have met some folks who said they liked their insurance until they had to use it, and then they figured out it didn't actually cover what they thought. And I've met plenty of folks who can't wait to turn 65 so that they can get the security that comes from Medicare. On the flip side, I've met young people who just aged out of their parents' plans when they turned 26. Nobody in their right mind would design a system like this from scratch. It's not really a system at all. It's just a patchwork, a crazy quilt that we've assembled. And we're going to need to take on the insurance industry and the drug companies if we want to extend coverage and improve quality and hold down costs, which is the goal of healthcare reform.
So you are a longtime educator. Let's talk a little bit about public education. I can see from your priorities on your website at andrewromanoff.com that you want to guarantee essentially universal pre-K and full-day kindergarten. Talk about that briefly, and then let's talk about the other end of the educational, I guess, journey, higher education.
Sure. I've met enough elementary school teachers and parents who can tell you that the kids who get the advantage of high-quality early childhood education are more likely to do well in school and less likely to fall behind or drop out. So the advantage of high-quality preschool and full-day kindergarten are obvious and monumental. It's one of the reasons that Governor Polis and the legislature here in Colorado are taking steps in that direction. I think it's a guarantee we ought to extend to all Americans. And it's one of the reasons I fought so hard when I was in the state legislature to increase funding not just for early childhood education, but for our schools generally. We're funding WAGS, the nation. I teamed up with a friend here who was the state treasurer at the time, a woman named Carrie Kennedy, to author the largest investment in school construction in state history. I worked on legislation to improve access to higher education. And I want to make sure that teachers actually get paid what they're worth, because we're losing a lot of good people to that profession because we have shortchanged it or blame them for everything that society itself fails to address.
What does that mean in terms of like tangible plans for higher ed?
The plan I believe we ought to extend says let's relieve students of that $1.5 trillion of debt they're carrying now, more than credit card debt, more than car loans. It's a huge drag on the economy and the productivity of the country, and obviously on the ability of a young person, or even a not so young person who's still saddled under that debt to find a job and buy a home and save enough for retirement. And I think just as we made a commitment in this country that a free education would be available through 12th grade, we need to recognize that a high school diploma is not enough to train someone for the sorts of jobs that the economy is now creating. It doesn't have to be a four-year degree, because not everybody wants one or gets one or needs one, but it's got to be some kind of post-secondary training. We've been talking to a lot of folks about apprenticeship programs, about community colleges like those in Colorado where I've taught, and about four-year institutions or beyond. I think we can make that commitment as a country. Several pieces of legislation in Congress that would do it. Obviously, the feds can't pick up the whole tab, and so most of the bills I've seen allow for a state share as well. And to be honest, Colorado needs to do a better job. We fell to something like 49th in the nation in public support for higher education and lost good jobs to other states that more effectively made that investment.
Andrew Romanoff, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
Andrew Romanoff is running for Senate in Colorado. You can find out more about Andrew's campaign over at andrewromanoff.com. Hey, that's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. Look, do us a favor. Subscribe to the free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio. It doesn't cost you anything. You can find it over at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your favorite podcast. You will hear things that you have missed during this show. But if you want to hear even more, sign up for our member show. It's the full radio program, but without commercials. Costs just a couple of pennies a day, and you support this program. You can find the member show over at ROFpodcast.com. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all of the social media. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And you can check out my daily show. It streams live every day at noon at majority.fm. There's also an app, majorityapp.com. Check it out. It's all free. Cover all the biggest news stories of the day and interview different folks. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio. Lights will guide.